episode 589 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Superman Sunday episode, and today I'm going to be continuing the chronology with a look at the World of Krypton number 2 from cover date January 1988. And I've only done one chronology episode so far. It's been tough to kind of squeeze them in with all the other Superman content I've been producing, but I do want to get back to the chronology, hopefully do it on a little more of a regular basis, at least a couple times a month. And what the chronology is, it's a look at Superman post-crisis when the powers that be at DC decided Superman needed to be depowered a little bit to make him a little more relatable and tell stories that were a little more modern in nature. And so what they did was they lured John Byrne away from Marvel Comics and gave him the reins, told him he's in charge of the whole Superman corner of the DCU. Now, looking back on it, there were some choices that Byrne made because, again, he had complete control that may have been mistakes from a certain perspective. It did bother some other people that were working at DC, and as much as Byrne had so much power as a writer, it's kind of understandable why they did it. He was one of the most popular creators at the time, and him being on Superman was a big deal that they were able to lure him away from Marvel. But some of the choices that he made it really tough for other stories to be told, right? Because one of the things that he did was he removed Superboy from the history of Superman. Clark Kent didn't become Superman until he was basically an adult, so there was no Superboy. And there was fallout from that because the Legion of Superheroes, you know, this huge franchise that had been incredibly popular in the early 80s, early to mid 80s really for DC, all of a sudden, how did that come about, right? It didn't make sense because the three original founding members had been inspired by Superboy, a character that now no longer existed. So some of the choices that Byrne made really made things more complicated, and they may, in retrospect, may not have been the best choices because part of what DC wanted to do with Crisis on Infinite Earths and this kind of reboot of their universe was to streamline everything, make it a little easier for new readers that were coming on, kind of clean up some of the continuity errors. But in a way, some of the choices that Byrne made actually created more problems than they actually solved. I understand, again, why Byrne made those choices. He wanted to simplify Superman. He wanted to bring back what was special about Superman. You know, supposedly the last son of Krypton, but, you know, 50 years of Superman stories up to that point, different writers had brought in, oh, this guy survived. Look at this long-lost person that survived the destruction of Krypton. Look at the bottled city of Kandor that survived. Oh, here's Supergirl. She survived. And all of a sudden, it became not as special to be Superman because he wasn't the only one who survived. So Byrne really wanted to strip it down, make it special, really have Superman Clark Kent be the only one that survived the destruction of his planet. And so that's why he made the choices he made. And again, we can understand it, but it did create some problems in its own right. The other thing that Byrne did was he wanted to give us some background into the world and the history of this new version of Superman that he had created. He did his 6-issue Man of Steel miniseries, which each issue was kind of a snapshot in time of the early years of Superman. But when they actually relaunched the titles, you know, Superman 1, they continued the numbering with Action Comics. The old Superman became Adventures of Superman. So they each had first issues of this new era of Superman, but They weren't stories of Superman debuting. They weren't stories of the early history of Superman, and they didn't give us background. We were kind of joining the story after, you know, Superman was already a known commodity. Those were the story. You know, he was already trusted by the, you know, the population of Metropolis, and he was, you know, already an established hero. We had that Man of Steel miniseries again with snapshots in time. You know, first time he meets Batman, first time when he's revealed as a hero, first time he meets Lex Luthor, Lois Lane, all that kind of stuff for the early days. But starting the regular series, it was, okay, Superman's already an established character. This is the new status quo, and it's new for us as the readers, and we are discovering things. But as far as the world of Superman, the world of DC, it has already been established for years. And so One of the ways that Byrne decided that he was going to fill in some of that backstory of this new version of Superman was to do a series of miniseries. So they had the four-issue World of Krypton miniseries. They had a four-issue World of Metropolis miniseries and a four-issue World of Smallville miniseries that kind of filled in some of the backstory of this version of Superman. There was also a 12-issue series called The Kents, which gave the backstory of kind of the Kents' ancestors, you know, first coming to the country and Old West and settling in Kansas and all that kind of stuff. And I think that was written by John Ostrander, actually, but I'm sure Byrne did have some input into that. And we will be talking about that in the chronology as well. But I decided to start with the World of Krypton for the chronology. We've already covered the first issue. And just to remind you, because it has been a little while since I've done a chronology episode, in that first issue, we saw Byrne's vision of what Krypton was like. You know, thousands of years in the past, it was very much an idyllic society. The people kind of lived forever. And the way they did that was everybody had three cells taken from them when they were born, and there were clones grown in a laboratory, and they were grown to certain stages in a person's life so that if they ever had some kind of life-threatening injury or disease or something, they could just go to the appropriate clone, harvest the materials they needed, whether it be a limb or an organ. And it could be grafted onto the original body. And so in that way, they prolong their lives indefinitely. Now, in the first issue, we saw there was another faction, a minority faction that disagreed with this idea of cloning. They felt it was abomination. They believed that these clones were basically people, and they were being murdered whenever they were being used to prolong the life of the original. Whereas for the majority of Kryptonians, they believed the clones just to be kind of mindless spare parts, so to speak. And we saw something in the first issue that kind of blew that theory out of the water. And once that genie was out of the bottle, war came to Krypton. And that's where this issue starts. It actually starts 1,000 years after that war had begun. And we do get some flashbacks of the beginnings of the war with Van-El. So let me go ahead and dive into the issue here. The creative team, it's written by John Byrne. We've got breakdowns by the legendary Mike Mignola. This is some of his really early work. And the finishes are by Rick Bryant, with colors by Petra Scotesi and letters by John Workman. So it starts off with a scene that's depicting that that hospital, that same spire, the clone repository, if you will. But it's that same spire we saw in the first page of World of Krypton number one, when it was blue skies and beautiful trees, green verdant landscape, and this futuristic spire rising up into that beautiful sky, and the Hantha trees were in blossom. And so 1,000 years, as I mentioned, have gone by, and things are not quite so bright and cheery. The text here says, "No blossoms now on spreading Hantha trees. Breezes coiling about their ragged limbs are like a fetid breath of hell. Scuttling Gonzaga lizards spit and hiss where once green grasses wave beneath the summer sun." And it's a very desolate landscape, right? Clearly ravaged by war. And through this landscape, there's a behemoth. It's actually Kryptonian battle suit, and it's lumbering through the blasted landscape, where it seems quite at home. You know, the bleakness and the fact that it's built for war, it very much suits this desolate landscape that's been ravaged by battle. So, as the suit is lumbering, we're getting more exposition. It's telling us that the battle suit has been lumbering straight for 28 days, heedless of the burning winds, just on a straight line, oblivious to anything it steps on. And it's just continued in the straight line on its mission. And its automated scanners can test the air and the soil, the very fabric of this shattered world. And inside it, protected in a nutrient bath, if you will, there's a fragile human form floating. And I do wonder about that term human. It's used to refer to Kryptonians several times throughout the issue, but it's they're not really humans, right? Aren't they Kryptonians? If they were human, then they wouldn't gain superpowers when they were exposed to a yellow sun. So I wonder if that's just kind of an oversight. But anyway, this figure who's floating in the nutrient bath appears to be sleeping, but that's not in fact the case. He is using his mind to drive the pumping legs of the war suit. And this figure is actually Van El, who we met in the first issue, who didn't really express much doubt about the way that clones were used. He had believed, like many of the Kryptonians, that first of all, it was foolish to think that clones had the ability to think for themselves and have their own personality, and thought it foolish that anyone would question the way of life that Krypton had embraced, this idea of using cloned material to prolong their lives. So he has been in this suit for a very long time, and he uses the myriad of sensors mounted all about the armor to kind of understand the world around him. And as he lumbers on, his eyes weep salt tears into the nutrients because of how much the world has been destroyed. And this is his home planet, his home world, and he weeps for the destruction he sees around him. So after 28 straight days of march, he finally sees his goal in sight. And it is indeed that spire, the clone repository that we saw on the first page. And so as he stumps across toward the remnant of this spire, this reminder of what used to be, he thinks back about finding out along with his father that one of the clones had been removed, and this clone of Nira was actually to be Kanzi's bride, right? So Nira so loved her son in almost a perverse way, you could say, that she wanted one of her clones to marry her own son. And that clone was freed by Nira and did have a personality, was a fully formed person. And it's really what sparked the war, because that was concrete proof that the clones were people, right? And they were being murdered for their body parts. And it's really what sparked the war. But it's almost like Ranel and Van-El and others of their same, I don't want to say faction, but just others of their same thought and their same belief system, they're in denial, right? I mean, the evidence is right there. Nira's clone was released. Nira's clone had become a fully formed, functioning Kryptonian. And that's clearly evidence that clones are more than just, mindless body parts. And so Van-El is thinking back to learning about this, and Ranel realizes that this means war. Van-El denies that. He says, Kryptonians are the Kryptonian civilization is too intelligent and civilized to ever go to war. And Ranel doesn't believe that. He's, all you've got to do is watch a vidicast from Kandor, the riots, the killings there. I was there. I saw it with my own eyes. And you have to remember that there was at one point in ancient times a league led by a pacifist that led these protests. His name was Senem. It was the League of Life, and they're the first ones that denounced the use of cloned material to prolong their lives. They believed that these clones were actually people, and they chose to die a natural death rather than prolong their lives through the use of clones and what they thought was barbarism and would ultimately lead to the downfall of Krypton. So again, Van-El clearly does not believe that war will come, but as he speaks to his father, they hear explosions, and it's only been a matter of hours since the news of this clone of Nira being a fully functioning Kryptonian has leaked out in a suicide note that was left behind by Kanzi, and already war has come to Krypton, and Van-El sees for himself that faction, the youth that have once again taken up the cause of Senem and his League of Life, that are fighting against the automated machines that defend the hospital, the clone repository. And as much as Van El thought he understood war, seeing the three-dimensional images related from the riots in Kandor just earlier that afternoon, he never really realized what true war was until he sees it right there with his own hand, his own eyes. He sees the destruction. He sees the death. He sees the after effects. And Ranel tells him, step back. You might be struck by a stray blast. This is the legacy of Senem. And, you know, except for the worst accidents, which are so rare in our perfect technocracy, rather, you know, a civilization built on technology, there's been no death of, it says no death of humans on Krypton. But again, it should be death of Kryptonians on Krypton for 3,000 generations, right? And the peaceful protests of a twisted old man, or of a kindly old man, rather, are being twisted to all of a sudden be an excuse for pain and devastation and war. And Senem himself would not have condoned what this new generation of his acolytes are doing. So as we turn the page, the flashback ends, and we see Van El continue to march in the battle armor toward the hospital, the clone repository. Meanwhile, he casts his mind back again as he and Ranel return to their home and talk to Ranel's wife, Ira, and she has news herself. And Vanel's betrothed, Vara, says, tell them. And the men have relayed their news about the hospital station being attacked, but Ira's news is much worse. The entire city of Kandor is gone. An organization calling itself Black Zero detonated an atomic in the heart of the city, and 40 million people have been blasted into atoms. And it's clear that this is a war that is not going to be over quickly. It's not a battle. It's not an uprising, but it clearly is war. It's a philosophical war. It's people that are passionate on both sides that are willing to fight to the death. And it's obvious that the blasted landscape that Van El marches through in his battle suit is the price that is paid for this philosophical difference of opinion and the passion of these two factions that are willing to do whatever it takes in order to promote what they believe is a proper way to live. Almost ironic in a way, because when war comes, regardless of the reason, nobody wins, really. And certainly it seems like the planet of Krypton has suffered the most. What you can almost think, what difference does it make if the clones are real people or not when you've destroyed an entire civilization and an entire planet, right? You would think they would be able to come to some more peaceful agreement rather than destroying an entire planet, because then neither side wins. Neither side gets to see life continue as they would have it, right? The old establishment that believes in the use of clones, clearly their way of life is no longer the same. They can't continue doing what they were doing. Technology is destroyed, and resources are destroyed, and people are killed, and so you can't continue living in the status quo and having things be okay. And for the other faction who denounces the use of clones, war has destroyed everything. So what were you fighting for? You were fighting to free the clones? Well, what difference does it make to free those clones when there's no world or civilization for them to live in? And how many of them survived the war anyway, right? So again, it just seems so futile, and really shows the senselessness of war. And I don't know if Byrne did that intentionally, but that's what I take from the story, at least through issue two. So, meanwhile, Van El's flashback continues as they leave, the other two to talk. And Van El and Vara, these two that are betrothed, realize that they have a difference of opinion as well. They're on different sides of this same argument, and it's very strange for them. Van El's extremely surprised to hear that Vara has her doubts about whether or not using clones is ethical, because we saw in the first issue that she had a terrible accident. And she wouldn't even be there. She wouldn't even still be alive if it wasn't for her cloned body parts. And she yells at Van El that, don't you think I realize that? Don't you think it makes me ill to think about such things? And if I only had the power, I would tear those cloned parts out of my body. And Van El's like, are you stupid? Like, you would be dead yourself if it wasn't for that. So Vara says, you know, my own father has expressed some doubts about the clone banks too. Why don't you ask your father if you think you know so much, boy? Which is an insult, a real big insult in Krypton, because you're considered a boy until you complete that ritual, the coming of age ritual, which is what Van El was actually trying to do in the first issue, but the ceremony was never completed. So even though he really is a man, he's not in the eyes of the society, that, and does it really matter, because it's beginning to break down anyway. But again, this is a society that's so long lived. In such a society, traditions and ceremony would mean so much more. It just, because it's been around for so long and they're so steeped in their traditions, and things like the coming of age ceremony take on so much more importance, because again, they're so long lived. It's, you've got to have these arbitrary kind of milestones, I guess you would say. So Van El says, that's hardly necessary to call me a boy. And as Ranel hears the commotion, he's like, what's all the shouting? And Vara says, nothing, only that I'm leaving. And we see her fly away with tears in her eyes. Meanwhile, back in the present day, in the blasted landscape, Van El is thinking about that word boy, and how even after 1,000 years, the word still burns in his mind. The war of clone rights coming on his day of coming of age, right? And the terrible murder and everything that happened after that. And in all the years since, he's never had the time to complete that ritual of manhood. And so again, there's part of him that still feels like he's not a true man. And as he gazes at the wreckage around him, he's thinking about Vara's cruel taunt, and it still bothers him to this day. So as he continues toward the tower, he uses the sensors of the suit to see that there are many humans, a pocket of again, humans, it's got to be Kryptonians, right? A pocket of soft, warm Kryptonian forms, and his heart is lifted. He thinks that perhaps he has found some clones that are still alive. He's found a pocket of Kryptonian society, and he's hoping, what exactly? We don't know. So he continues below the jagged rim, where the sensors tell him that the temperature drops and it seems like a much less harsh environment, and that he may be able to survive outside of the Kryptonian suit. And as he heads toward where that pocket of Kryptonians is that the suit sensors have detected, he realizes as he gets lower into the tangled mess of the wreckage, he's going to have to exit his suit, because there's just not enough room for the suit to maneuver around and find these survivors. So the suit finally stops after 28 straight days of marching, and Van El uses the sensors to do one more scan to tighten it, to zoom in with the resolution. He sees 30 humans, and he decides that it's worth it to leave the Kryptonian battlesuit for the first time in nearly 100 years. So as he's basically sheds the armor, he's kind of birthed into this wreckage of a world. the war suit disgorges him along with the nutrient fluids, the bath that he was swimming in. And the temperature is really no colder than, you know, typical autumn evening. And the air is a little bit dusty and there's a lot of odors, but it is safe to breathe. But Van El, for having spent 100 years in that nutrient bath, just the fact that he has air on his skin causes him great agony. And the stench revolts him and he nearly vomits. But eventually the seizures pass, and he works the stiffness out of his limbs and starts getting used to the idea of body weight again, even though all the movements cause him great agony and his muscles tremble. He eventually feels somewhat normal. And he goes to a storage locker in the foot of one of the armor's feet and pulls out a tack suit and puts it on. And as he does, he realizes he's not alone. He's told to freeze, and a Kryptonian scavenger is there and refers to him as a Sider, short for outsider, and asks who he is and what he's doing there. And Van El realizes that although it's tough to understand, he does understand what this Kryptonian is saying. But when he goes to respond, he realizes that a century of disuse has closed his throat, right? He's only able to make a gurgling sound, which is not nearly enough for the soldier who fires at his feet. But Van El, with a series of gestures, makes himself understood that he can't talk. And so the scavenger says, okay, well, come with me and we'll see what we can do about finding out who you are and where you come from. So Van El hits a switch on the suit and follows this scavenger to the pocket of remaining Kryptonians. And as they travel along, the only thing Van El is for sure about is that he's being surrounded by other scavengers, and they're all watching and waiting. And as he travels through deeper into the wreckage, he's thinking back to when he joined the Army of the Establishment to fight against this new version of the League of Life. And having attacked them, death to the rebels and the betrayers, he's able to get into kind of the base of Black Zero. And he's surprised by what he sees, because they just appear to be people, just normal Kryptonians, not the monsters he had built them up to in his mind, not raving madmen. And so as the rebels flee, Van El actually tackles one of them, saying, "Not so fast. My commander will have a few questions for you." And as that rebel turns over, Van El sees that it's Vara, and he's shocked as Vara kicks him to try to escape and says, "Yes, get off me." And Van El is too shocked to even chase after her. He wants to understand. He says, "Vara, you can't be with Black Zero. Please come back," as she attempts to run and escape. But as soon as she gets outside, she's blasted by one of the other members of the establishment army. And Van El has lost his beloved, and he still feels the pain of that loss. So after what feels like hours of walking and thinking about Vara being taken from him, Van El finally reaches the pocket of Kryptonians, survivors, but it's not what he expects to see at all. He feels like he's looking down into the face of hell and thinks to himself, who are these people? They're all broken and shattered. It's not at all what Van El expected to see. He expected to find a pocket of Krypton with technology intact and maybe a place to start rebuilding from. And his guide says, "You got a lot of questions? Well, you'll get your answers. But after we get ours, now move." And he takes her to the leader of this pocket of Kryptonian humanity that remains. And his guide says, "The Doc R will see you soon when she's ready." So as the leader shows up, she says, "Well, the soldier tells me you can't speak, and that's not good, because everybody around here has to make themselves useful, and outsiders are only useful if they can talk. They have information." So Van El struggles to make himself heard and use his vocal cords, and he's finally able to say who he is. "You know, my name is Van El, and I'm president of the World Council." So clearly there's some things that have gone on that we're not aware of. When we last left him, he was you know, a boy about to become a man. And in the ensuing years, he's become president of the government, what established government there is left on Krypton. And Doc R says, you know, I know that name. And as for your would-be government, what brings you so far from home and safety? And Van-El says, I'm here because Black Zero's reborn and they're threatening to destroy all of Krypton. And Doc R says, well, that seems kind of redundant. Did you not just walk across the landscape? You should know that Krypton is already destroyed. And Van-El says, no, you don't understand. I did notice the blasting of the landscape, but such things can be repaired given enough time. But the weapon Black Zero currently has, it's a means to shatter the whole planet. And unless they can stop them, Krypton will explode. And that's how the issue ends. So is that the destruction of Krypton that we know? Is that explosion of Krypton the one that was the catalyst for Jor-El to build the rocket ship that sent Superman to Earth? I guess we'll find out in the next issue. So again, I love this dystopian tale that Byrne is telling. One thing that is a challenge for him is that he is telling thousands of years of history in only four issues. So real estate's at a premium, and it makes sense that he's telling this kind of non-linear storyline where we got a huge jump, a jump of 1,000 years between issue one and issue two. And then we get some flashbacks in issue two to let us know what happened, to fill in the gaps and help us to understand. And it's really a way, again, for Byrne to flesh out the ideas that he has about his version of Krypton, being that it was very cold and emotionless, very much a technocracy based on science, not based on necessarily human interaction and such. And everything that happened in issue one and issue two is building toward that society, that place where Krypton was in its civilization and in its history and in its evolution, that helps explain why it exploded and why it was the society that it was, and helps to set up other aspects of the story of Clark Kent and the story of Superman going forward as John Byrne saw it. Now, some of these things have changed. They're not necessarily canon anymore because, again, this stuff is like 30 years old now, mid-80s. So some of them have changed, but I do feel like there's a lot of worth in this because I feel like a lot of Krypton in other media comes from a lot of the seeds that Byrne lays in this World of Krypton miniseries. Again, not everything is the same. Other things have been added. Some things have been changed. Some other things have been taken away a little bit. But for the most part, this idea of technocracy obviously is very prevalent in shows like Krypton, in the Man of Steel movies and things like that. And so there is worth here. And plus, it's just a great story and incredible art from Mike Mignola. He does a great job of portraying the desolation of the landscape, and a great job of taking us through the emotion that Van-El feels both in the flashbacks when he's confronted with this overnight change in his life, this huge change in the civilization of Krypton as war breaks out, plus the argument with Vara and the discovery of Vara being Black Zero later in the story. And then in the present day of the story, Van-El discovering that this pocket of Kryptonian humanity that he had discovered and hoped would help him is in no shape to really help him at all. But he still tells Doc R about Black Zero, because what choice does he have, right? They've got to find a way to stop it, even if it is bringing this ragtag group of survivors who barely seem able to take care of themselves and scrape out an existence. If that's the army that Van-El is going to have to raise and have to use to stop Black Zero, then so be it. What other choice does he have, right? The other choice is oblivion with the complete destruction of Krypton. So I love the World of Krypton series. I think it's my favorite of the world of stories that Byrne's telling. And I do kind of wonder, because if I remember correctly, the other two were drawn by Byrne, the Metropolis and the Smallville. This one was Mignola, and obviously, you know, Byrne can't do it all. He did the Man of Steel series. He was drawing and writing Superman. He was drawing and writing Action Comics. He was writing Adventures of Superman comics. There's no way he could have done everything. But I remember being disappointed at the time, and there's still part of me that feels like I wish. I would be curious to see how Byrne would have depicted the society. That being said, I think Mignola, and again, really early work from him, I think he's a perfect choice just because of his style, right? It is so perfectly suited for this story of Krypton that takes a darker turn, right? Plus, he's great at drawing things that are kind of esoteric and not, that don't look normal in terms of Earth standards, you know, that alien skyline, alien landscapes and the flying ships and the technology and things like that. Just like Jack Kirby was so great at drawing like the Fantastic Four stuff, you know, with the technology and the machines and all the cosmic stuff of the Fantastic Four, because that was just Kirby's style, right? It worked so well. Mignola the same way, right? Being able to draw these spires and Kryptonian battle armor and, as I mentioned, the flying machines and things like that. It's a good marriage. It's a good choice if Byrne himself wasn't going to do it. And perhaps it's even better than if Byrne himself had done it. You know, obviously we don't know because Byrne, we don't see any of Byrne's art other than some of the covers of these issues. But all in all, it's a great series. I really encourage you to go and check it out. You can find it. They just actually reprinted this whole four-issue World of Krypton miniseries recently because of the sci-fi Krypton series. So it's currently in print right now, and you can find it pretty readily. So I would encourage you guys to go and pick it up. And again, Byrne, I think he did the cover for issue number one. The cover for this issue number two, is actually Walter Simonson, who's another legendary penciler, obviously. And it's really cool. We see in the background the flying army of the Kryptonian establishment, as well as some explosions as they're fighting the new version of the League of Life. And in the foreground is a Kryptonian battle suit, like the one that Van-El is wearing in the story. So again, great art, great story. And really, really worth your time to read. So as I mentioned at the top of the episode, hope to get back to the chronology sooner than later with issue 3 and 4. Well, issue 3 for an episode, then issue 4 for another. But I think next week on Superman Sunday, the plan is to talk about Superman number 5, which came out on, I believe, was it the 7th or the 8th? Yeah, the 7th of November. So that'll be what we are covering next. And then the following Sunday will be Supergirl number 24, which also came out on November 7th. And then probably the first Sunday of December, I'll get a chance to get back to the chronology with World of Krypton number 3. So as always, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.